Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
I cover all things food, from cooking to gardening to fabulous ingredients to junk food, health, sustainability, even policy. You might say I'm obsessed with everything about food. Food is the one substance that connects everything to everything else, and it connects us all. Not only can we not live without it, not only does it determine much of what goes on in the world, but we love it. Hi, it's Mark Bittman, and welcome to Food. As is perhaps fitting for this episode, I'm in Bermuda, and you are hearing some feral Bermuda roosters, which I'm recording this at 7:30 in the morning. The roosters have been going literally since 3 in the morning. I did get a couple hours of sleep. They started at 3. They went till 3:30 or 4. They stopped. They started again at 6. They haven't stopped since. As I said, they are feral, and I haven't figured out a way to stop them. A chicken guy, a guy who calls himself a chicken guy, came and took 3 of them away a couple of weeks ago, but they were immediately replaced by 3 others. Or maybe he pretended to take 3 of them away. Or maybe he admonished them. I'm not in favor of killing them, but I'd love to figure out a way to get them out of here. I tried to physically wrangle one of them away from here, and he mauled me. So that wasn't so smart. I'm a city kid. I know nothing. Anyway, I'm in Bermuda. We have beautiful water, beautiful sky, beautiful sun, beautiful flowers, miserable roosters, and lots of fish. And that's what we're talking about today. Not everybody knows this about me, but I began my food writing career writing about fish. My first cookbook was called Fish, and that had followed maybe 10 years of passionately writing about fish. I was working in fish, even for National Marine Fisheries Service. I was cooking fish so much that my kids still complain about it. I just really had an affinity for fish. And the funny thing about those days, we're talking about the early 80s, the concern among many people involved in the fisheries world, National Marine Fisheries people, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, which ran a thing called Sea Grant, was that there was concern about overfishing, as there is now, but there was also concern about underfishing. So there was a feeling that if we could promote what they called underutilized species, and some people called trash fish, we could save some of the more valuable fish like tuna and cod. two of the fish that were being threatened back then and still are. That didn't work. The fish that were underutilized at the time, or many of them, I'm thinking of monkfish, I'm thinking of skate, some flounders, mackerel even, many of those so-called underutilized fish began to sell, in part thanks to the promotions that we were doing around how good they were, and of course they are good eating fish, but also because the voracious demands of the aquaculture industry, the farm-raised fish industry, meant that fish had to be swept up from the oceans by the millions to be ground into fish feed, not only for fertilizer, which was a traditional use, but now also for fish food. So let's bring it forward to today, when even more advanced technology allows ships to go into the middle of the ocean and literally vacuum a fish willy-nilly. The fish that's wanted is kept on board. The fish that's not is thrown back overboard, called bycatch, but effectively killed. And as everyone knows, a variety of species of fish are in trouble, probably more than half. One unusual thing that not everybody knows is that the United States is actually better about regulating its fishing industries than almost any other country, and maybe any other country in the world, but our influence can only govern our own waters, probably a good thing, but what we need here is some kind of international agreement. There are a few that are pending, and there are some that are in force, but they're not effective enough. Piracy is a big issue. Overfishing in general is a big issue. We know that pollution and the effects of climate change are huge issues in our waters. Anyone who snorkels or scuba dives knows that reefs are smaller and there are fewer fish than there used to be. And anyone who fishes will tell you that there are fewer fish than there used to be. These are real things. So this is a long way of introducing my guest today, who is Ted Danson. You know Ted from Cheers and The Good Place and Curb Your Enthusiasm and several other shows. But Ted founded an organization called Oceana, and he is currently on its board of directors. And Ted is a passionate and, as you'll see, articulate advocate for sane fisheries management and sane protection of our oceans. It's a great conversation. And then when Ted and I are done, I'll follow up a little bit with Daniel Pauly, who's a well-known marine biologist who I've spoken to a number of times over the years, also associated with Oceana, although he does other work as well, from his home in British Columbia. So if you're interested in fish, if you're interested in oceans, this is a great show for you. If you don't think you are, it's a great opportunity for you to learn. And I'll be back in a minute with Ted Danson. Much as I would love to give you what you might call Bermuda fish recipes, there really aren't very many. There's a chowder that can be pretty good, but it's hard to find a good version of it, so I can't say that I've recreated an authentic one. There's an awesome fried fish sandwich, often served on raisin bread. We'll get into that some other time. It's pretty funny. But one thing you do see is fish kebabs, and you see them made of wahoo, of mahi-mahi, of yellowfin tuna, of sometimes swordfish, ocean fish mostly. But this is a recipe that'll work with just about any firm-fleshed fish, and that people around here make a lot, and I make a lot. So you start by making a paste from a few cloves of garlic with some salt and pepper, some lemon juice, fresh herbs if you have them, oregano, marjoram, parsley, combination of those. Cilantro is good in this too. And olive oil. Really mash that up and make it into a paste. Take fish. You want big steaks to the extent you can get them for this, and cut it into 2-inch chunks, big chunks. Rub that with the paste. Thread it onto skewers. And then grill, preferably over real charcoal or even wood, turning as much as it's needed. I would pay attention to this. You want a beautiful grilled piece of fish, until the fish is firm and a little bit browned, of course, even blackened. That shouldn't take more than 5-8 minutes tops. And then they're ready. Serve that with lemon wedges and rice or potatoes or salad or whatever you want. That is one of my all-time standby grilled fish recipes and some great eating. So I didn't have the heart to tell Ted Danson that I never once watched Cheers, though it turns out he doesn't care. Anyway, we all know Ted Danson for his TV roles, but the thing is that he's an advocate for fish in the sea, and he's not only a spokesperson for Oceana, the world's largest ocean conservation group, he started it. So he's totally cool and a great guy. Here's my talk with the most sympathetic demon in primetime. You know, I want to talk about Oceana, but I want to talk about fish. Everything that you read scares the bejesus out of you about fish. It's like you can't eat anything, and it would seem that a principled person would just throw their hands up and say, maybe I can eat sardines and oysters, but after that, you know, it's like there's nothing sustainable anymore. And as soon as you say something is sustainable, everybody eats it and it becomes unsustainable. But Oceana has a kind of eat fish friendly position on this. And I'd like to hear that explanation.
Eat small, wild, and local is basically what you just said. And that is a good rule of thumb. Because when you get into the larger fish, then you are definitely consuming more mercury than you want. You know, just the way things happen. You burn coal, the mercury falls into the water, the little fish get it through the gills, and then by the time that little fish is a really big fish, it's eaten so many other fish with mercury in them that it's really not safe for you. For real.
Right.
So we realized what we were doing was basically save the oceans, feed the world, and not just as a spin to get people's attention, because if you talk fish, which we're doing, you could put people to sleep in 5 minutes. But if you talk about feeding the world, you get a whole another group coming to the table, a group of funders, group of people interested, because that is a big subject. How do we feed the world with populations exploding? And as soon as you move from poverty to out of poverty, one of the first things you want is animal protein in your diet. Mm. And so the stress on land animals is getting worse and worse and worse. So you have here a perfect protein in that you don't use fresh water to make it. You don't cut down a rainforest to make it. You don't, you know, fish don't create all that methane or whatever it is. You know, land-based agriculture is one of the biggest drivers of climate change, of global warming.
Right.
You could have 1 billion fish meals a day sustainably, every day, forever. Now, that's huge. We're at about 500 or 600 million right now. If you went up to 1 billion, all of a sudden, you're taking a huge amount of stress off of land because you're creating a protein that the world needs. That argument now, all of a sudden, gets people's attention. It's the truth. And to do all of those things, to make your fisheries healthy, you have to do all the right things for the ocean, even if you were never going to eat a fish. You have to deal with pollution. You have to deal with all the things that are happening to our oceans.
I mean, how do you even talk about a sustainable habitat for fish when the water's
warming to the point
warming,
where
there's more acid in it, there's less oxygen, the fish are having trouble breathing or destroying. I mean, the habitat is not only being destroyed by overfishing, it's being destroyed by calcification and acidification and all of that stuff. So, is Oceana working on that?
We're an ocean group, and we've always tried not to be anything but that, so that we can remain effective and not try to tackle everything out of exuberance. Clearly, climate change, global warming, water's warming, water's pH balance changing because of acidification, because of all the carbon that's drifting down into the water and it's changing the pH balance. And all of that is huge. It is the biggest game in town.
Right.
Saddest, scariest. UN came out with all of that information of, you know, if the world wanted to tackle this immediately and change their ways drastically, we could, you know, have an impact that would lessen what's happening to us.
So what can, you know, this sort of action question that people always, when you're in a public speaking and people start, you open to questions, everyone always says, well, what can I do? There's never an event where someone doesn't say that. So short term on fish, I think we've kind of talked about how to shop and
and how to think about it. But what can people do?
I think you also have to say what's at stake, because otherwise you put people to sleep, because what's the problem? I can get a piece of fish anywhere. I can go around the corner and get a fried fish sandwich, whatever. So it's hard. You have to get people to realize, for example, the health issue. We touched on it, but in the Bush administration, EPA, way back, you know, which was a relatively conservative organization, one out of six women of childbearing years have too much mercury in their system to safely give birth to a child without the potential for neurological damage. And that comes from mercury, which comes from fish, which comes from coal companies burning, you know, their coal and putting mercury out into the air. So now, all of a sudden, you get people's attention. Wait a minute. So I shouldn't eat the larger fish that have more mercury in them? I will learn what that is. I am interested now. Wait, seafood fraud? I'm being cheated? Wait a minute. Now I'm interested. So what you can do, you know, is educate yourself on the fish that's good for you to eat. Small local wild is an easy way to go. You know, you educate yourself not to be a good environmentalist, but because of your health, you know, because of that's real.
Right.
So if you let science lead the way, stop being wasteful and you stop being destructive, fisheries, by and large, will come back. You know, if you draw a circle and inside that circle you don't fish anymore, and you know, you can categorize, maybe you can do no commercial fishing and maybe recreational. You know, there are different ways to categorize that protected area. But the fish start bubbling over the side of that circle. And so fishermen are also, when they actually do it, happy with the results. You create more fish, more jobs, more money, if you do it correctly.
What's the relationship between you and Oceana, and how'd you get? I mean, we talked about this 7 years ago, so this is real for you. This is you're doing this. You've been doing it a while.
Yes, I have. The reasons why are strange or hard to kind of. Actually, you know, the older I get, to realize, I'll answer your question about when all this started. But I've been doing it.
Yeah, we want the weird reasons.
Yeah, I started about 30 years ago, in the middle of the Cheers rock and roll years, and combination of things. Cliche, but true. I was walking on a beach with my daughters, just moved into Santa Monica, and they were young kids, and we bumped into a sign that said, you know, no swimming, water polluted. And I couldn't explain why or how. And it was a gorgeous day, and the ocean looked spectacular. Then I also met a man who was fighting Occidental Petroleum from digging, slant drilling 60 oil wells into the Santa Monica Bay here, right along PCH. And the fight had been going on for years. And we met, liked each other, came up with an idea to how to stop them permanently, and it worked.
Wow.
And we liked the conversation, and we liked each other's company. So out of naivete, we started, you know, my father has a barn, let's put on a play kind of thinking, and we had hired somebody, and we were in basically our garage, and we started American Oceans Campaign. And it was really well respected in Washington. We were kind of not the first, but we were the beginning wave of people talking about oceans. Then about 15 years ago, Pew started Oceana, and we merged with them.
Ah.
So, you know, in one way, creating an organization around me with Bob Sulnick and all these people who are on the board and everything was really smart, because I'm as flaky as any decent Los Angeles actor.
Right, but you have awesome name recognition.
No, what I mean is I couldn't quit. I couldn't be flaky. You know, it was like I surrounded myself with these amazing people. And I've always known that my job was, you know, thank you for watching Cheers. While we're talking, do you mind if I introduce you to this marine biologist who has something really important to say?
Right.
You know, I'm the shill in front of the tent where the good stuff is happening.
You're about to start a new season of Curb Your Enthusiasm?
I am indeed.
Are you excited about that?
I always love going to work with Larry David, and I have to credit him. He did changed things around for me, because Mary and I both started that show. For me, it was when I had just finished Cheers and Becker, and I felt like I had stayed at the half-hour comedy sitcom too long, and I wasn't amusing myself, and other people were doing it better, so I was kind of unenthusiastic about acting. And he kind of rehabilitated me, because you just went and had fun. And there was no studying. You just showed up and played. And it really reinvigorated me. And I think it also gave people another shot at me in a different way. So I do credit him, as much as I hate to in public, for, changing my life.
So is it sort of, is showing up there the opposite of showing up at the good, like the good place is like completely scripted and this is completely unscripted?
Both those things. And the good place, you have to be like your version of a top athletic form, because you need that clean, bright energy, and your brain needs to be sharp, because you're basically on our show like learning iambic pentameter. It's like really elevated kind of speech. So you work your ass off to be good at it.
Right.
And then you need a clean, high energy to do it. Whereas you can show up drunk, divorced, and depressed. And who gives a shit, kind of thing. And it still works.
That's super interesting. And you can see it. But, it's funny that Curb has kind of polished that is coming from somewhere. And
well,
just
he
like
writes,
brilliant
for 4
people
months,
together. But
he writes and works on everything that you would do to create a half-hour script, he does, right up until, okay, go write the dialogue. So everything is planned out and beats, and he knows where he needs to go. But then you go play. But the first time you do it in front of the cameras, it sucks, because all improvisation sucks. And then you go, well, don't do that, do this. That was funny, do that. And by the fourth time you've done it, you've almost improvised the script.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
2 years ago, I said, because so much TV is so bad, but you're always like looking for something that you like.
Right.
And 2 years ago, someone said, you should watch this thing, The Good Place. So I started watching The Good Place the first season, and then Kate, my daughter's into it, my partner Kathleen's, everybody I know is into it. So, in the first season, The Good Bad Place, or The Bad Good Place, whatever you refer to it as, The Good Place, that's really The Bad Place. There's this ongoing frozen yogurt joke.
Right.
So what is your idea of like food in hell, and what's your idea of food in heaven? Like, what is frozen yogurt really like? Something worth demonizing, or is
well,
there...
I think there was this wonderful line that I will butcher, that humans so cleverly took something really good, ice cream, and made it just a little less good and called it frozen yogurt. Why would you do that? Why would you take something great and make it less great? My hell foods now are a beautifully gorgeous cooked steak, because I can't eat it. So that's hell.
Right.
I'm not saying people shouldn't, but I can't,
You can't because you're a vegetarian? You can't,
no, because my body hurts when I...
300?
All of the above.
Right.
But now sugar is just... Sugar, carb, fast-burning carbs. And this is not L.A. talking, it's my body.
Right.
I've now reached the point where my tolerance is very little for foods that, cause inflammation. So... And I promised my wife I wasn't going to use the word inflammation.
You promised you weren't?
I know. It's a tough
Let's
one.
Are we going to have an old person conversation here?
No, we're not. No, because I've promised my therapist never to have an old person conversation.
What about foods that you really like? Can we go there?
I basically do like Mediterranean. I do like my body and me. I mean, I may like the taste of different things, but I just don't enjoy the aftermath. Let's start with tequila. Tequila is a God-given drink that I still enjoy.
No inflammation there?
None that I can remember.
Right.
I love fish. I love fish. I love turkey. I love chicken. I do really well with those. And I love olive oil. And I love garlic and sautéed, collard greens with garlic that's kind of crispy and brown. And, you know, I'm thrilled to eat that. I'm thrilled to eat a sweet potato. But not just because it's good for me. I like, you know, eating sweet potato with some sort of butter or butter substitute or olive oil and cinnamon is, to me, like having a good pie.
Do you cook?
I am a short order cook. I'm not your dinner chef.
You're like scrambled eggs, BLT.
Anything that's in the refrigerator, I can make for you, and I enjoy that short order. Let me feed the family. But then when it comes to dinner, I'm speechless.
When you're working, when you're on the road, what do you eat then? Like when you're not at home, when you're doing these 12-hour days and people are shoving junk food at you, I've been on sets. What do you do then? How do you eat decently when it's not under your control as much?
You can always get egg whites. I have egg whites. I have turkey. You know, I'll have egg whites, turkey, and a corn tortilla for breakfast and be really happy.
Yeah,
and maybe a little green salsa and be really, really happy. I used to put goat cheese in it, and maybe every once in a while I would. That kind of breakfast. Lunch is easy. You know, I get the blandest. I ask people to bring it to me so I don't go through the actual line. Because if you look at the food that's available, you'll just stuff yourself. So now I eat, you know, a piece of chicken or a piece of fish, plain, no condiments, and broccoli. So you get slightly bored halfway through eating it and you don't eat too much. You know,
it's a good strategy, yeah. Actually.
And really, my body's gotten to the point where it's like, here's the deal, Ted. You can eat or a lot, or you can have energy to do these 12-hour days. What do you want to do? And I really do have to choose.
All right. You can eat whatever you want, or you can feel good. Choose one.
Yeah.
And I'm so happy. It's so much fun to talk with you.
It is really nice to talk to you, too. This is great coffee, by the way.
I hope you all enjoyed that interview with Ted, and we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with Dr. Daniel Pauly. We'll talk quite seriously about some of the issues in our oceans and with fish today.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Have you ever bought something, owned something that really inspired you to up your game? A tennis racket, a new pair of running shoes, a new piece of cooking equipment that made you just want to cook your brains out? I know that when I first started cooking on induction burners, I just couldn't stop. It was so much fun. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Some of the features that are available on this car include Dynamic Sky Panorama Glass Roof, Front Row Massaging Seats, you know you want that, available 33-inch all-terrain tires, which you will want when you check out the Multi-Terrain Select. These are really great features, the kind of features that will make you proud and happy to own a Lexus GX. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX. Luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
Dr. Pauly, when it comes to fish, there are two kinds of sustainability that we might be talking about. There's the whole overfishing issue, and then there's the climate crisis, which is determining the nature of the oceans in a way that nothing in recorded history has ever done. So how do we think about them differently and together? Or am I wrong? Is there some other way to look at it?
Oh, there is a strong link between the two. I might elaborate on this point first. So overfishing is catching less fish with more effort than you actually would need to catch more fish. This is the incredible stupidity of it all. So you deploy boats and you use energy that generate greenhouse gases in order to catch less fish than you would if you fished less. The second link, bottom trawling, steer up the sediment and resuspend it. This paper that was published in Nature a month ago indicates that lots of carbon dioxide is set free and goes back into the atmosphere. Now, so over the millennia, over millions of years, a huge amount of carbon has been drawn from the atmosphere and sedimented in the seas, right? And piles of rock like shales and stuff, that's all sediment. Sediment with organic matter, this carbon that was buried, that is a huge reason not to have trawling. Mm-hmm. And trawling is also a devastating gear in terms of it catches at most 50% of the species it targets, even in northern countries and in temperate cold water countries where there are fewer species. The target species makes 50% perhaps of the catch, and the rest is bycatch, which is discarded. So that is.
And discarded means killed. It's not discarded to the ocean alive. Sure. It's killed. Yeah.
We know that trawling is reshaping undersea landscape and seascapes in that it flattens everything, and it has become a geologic force.
Right. The better comparison might be strip mining.
Yeah. Yeah.
Literally cutting off the tops of mountains, right?
There was already a case against trawling, but it has become immensely more stronger with that recent paper. The case against trawling was destruction of habitat, destruction of biodiversity, and competition against small scale fishers that are whose livelihood is wiped out by trawlers and so on. This recent paper, it adds to the case that can be made against trawler.
How do we make fishing sustainable? How do we make it so that we can still be fishing and fish can still be feeding people 100 years from now?
Abandon this idea of sustainability, because though in principle this is a good thing, we are in a situation with most fisheries in most countries where the biomass of fishable life has now been reduced enormously. And so sustaining that is not a good policy. And in fact, what you need is to rebuild abundance. And the U.S. has an explicit policy. It's called the Magnuson-Stevens Act, that any stock that is identified as overfished has to be rebuilt within 10 years. But it's the U.S. is the only country of the world that where this kind of legislation has passed and been successfully implemented. If you rebuild in a major industrialized country, you reduce the incentive for sending boats out there in the middle of nowhere, in the global south, the fish that people need to eat, as opposed to us who eat fish for fun or for pleasure. Mm-hmm. And is the neglect of our own fisheries in the global north has caused the demand by the global north to be satisfied by the global south.
Where people actually need to fish to eat. Isn't there a sort of paradox that the United States can have these laws that say we are going to rebuild the stocks, but then import as much fish as we want to from everywhere in the world where the stocks are not being rebuilt?
Yep. And that is where the problem is, that this abundance has to be rebuilt everywhere. Canada, for example, had a monster stock of cod. Actually, it is this cod was behind the founding of Canada by settlers from France and England, right? Because they went to fish cod in Newfoundland and so on. And this fishery, which lasted about 5 centuries, produced 100,000 to 200,000 tons a year. Without interruption, 200,000 tons. Then in the 60s, late 50s, 60s, trawlers came into the picture from Europe. And we were fishing like crazy, down to 1 kilometer depth. We were fishing the capital or in a bank vault instead of going to the teller and getting the interest from whatever we have in a bank, right? We could get into the bank vault with a truck. And that was what's done. And lasted about 20 years, and then it was over. And now, instead of 200,000 tons, they catch 10,000 tons. And this minuscule catch is enough to prevent the stock from rebuilding.
Really? Right? But to go back to Magnuson Stevens, the way this works is that you say, here's a formula by which in 10 years, the existing principle of fish can reproduce at a rate that will get us to abundance again in 10 years. And the quotas are based on that.
Yep. And not only are the quota based on that, but if they are not, you can sue them.
And this is a good plan for local fisheries. And I guess there's a way you can argue that fisheries, for most fish, are local. When you're talking about cod, you're talking about Gulf of Maine, George's Bank, and so on. You're not talking about a global population.
Yeah. And people say, oh, fish know no border and stuff. It's all nonsense. Actually, fish know borders. Because borders of temperatures and so on, water currents and so on, they know borders, they have borders, but fleets don't.
Right.
And also the market has no limit. It cannot be saturated anymore because we have, for all purpose, an infinite market.
What's the advice to the individual, to the eater, in terms of fish? Can we be agnostic about what we eat? Do we have to take care of what we eat? Should we not be eating fish at all?
No. When young people ask me, what should I do? Mm. Should I eat this or that? I say, you cannot run a thing with your stomach. You have to run it with your head and with your heart, but not your stomach. Nothing has ever been changed by changing consumer behavior. The small percentage of people who do it voluntarily is the ferment that changes things, but it becomes effective only when that ferment catches on. And it catches on when it connects with governments. And it often usually connects through civil society.
You're speaking about making change, which of course I'm in complete support of. But again, putting the cognitive dissonance question aside, you say that individuals, some percentage of individuals should and will act according to their beliefs. When it comes to people in North America, what should those beliefs look like as people who buy and eat fish?
Perhaps linking with, if this exists, with community-based fishing. We have one in Vancouver, group called Skipper Otto, that is artisanal. The fishing is small. We give them money in advance of the season. $300, $500, something. Mm-hmm. It allows them to equip themselves for the season. They go fishing, and then we get access to whatever they have fished. We have no issue with provenance. We know what it is. We have no issue with slavery on board of the ship and so on. If you get that kind of community-based fisheries, that is one thing one can propose. But there are very few community-based fisheries in North America.
Right.
I think it was 16 of them, and only two or one in Canada. But community-based farming is known, right?
Yeah,
you can go to that. Perhaps initiating something like that would be a good thing. If you have local label, we have a local label here called Oceanwise. It's one thing. But again, you can follow the Monterey Aquarium guidelines, and they have little. But the point is not to be satisfied with yourself if you do that. You have to do more than that. Consumers is one aspect of your personality, but really the important one is the citizen.
The difference between consumer and citizen is critical. That's really great. Dr. Pauly, thank you.
You're welcome.
In keeping with our fish theme, this is steamed fish over garlicky rice. And I gotta say, I've just fallen in love with this. I learned it in Italy a couple of years ago, but of course there are variations all over the world. Make some rice. Generally speaking, I'm an advocate of brown rice, but I gotta say, this is an elegant dish. So if you don't want to compromise, do what I'm about to say. You can make the usual predictable compromises, of course, but make some white rice. Let's say for four people, 2 cups. That is, start with 1 cup of white rice, which will produce a couple of cups. Cook that pretty much as normal, and then put it into a skillet with, let's say, half a stick of butter, salt, and lots of black pepper. Stir that around until the grains start to separate, and then add about, let's say, a teaspoon of minced garlic, and then stir that around until it becomes fragrant. Taste that. It should be garlicky, it should be salty, it should be buttery. If it's not, fix it. I warned you about the roosters. There they are. On that rice, lay as many fillets of white-fleshed fish as will fit. You can use thin-cut halibut. Down here in Bermuda, we use wahoo. In Italy, where I learned this, they used lake fish, freshwater fish. Anything will work. Firm fleshed fillets are best, but tender ones are fine too. Just put a layer of that fish on top of that rice, more salt and pepper, and more butter, and if you like, a little more garlic too. Cover that and cook over very low heat for like 5 minutes until a thin-bladed knife pierces the fish with little resistance. That's it. Taste, make sure your seasoning's okay, serve with lemon. That is like one of the great simple fish dishes of all time, and I've been making it a lot. Enjoy that. Okay, now's when we're going to answer a few questions from listeners.
Hi, this is Helen Conroy. So you're out running errands, and you bump into someone you haven't seen in ages. They invite you to dinner that evening, and you ask, what can I bring? The they say, well, we can always use more dessert. You have no time for shopping between now and then, but you want to bring something you've made yourself. Using what's in your pantry and fridge, and given the time constraints, what will you bring?
Kate Bittman, my older daughter, writes for the Bittman Project, does most of our social media, does a great deal of cooking for herself, her husband, and her young child, Holden, who happens to be my grandson. And she will weigh in from time to time on issues of general interest and on any cooking issue that involves children.
So I have two answers to this question, and they're both cookies. The first one is the two-ingredient banana oatmeal cookies from How to Bake Everything. And I mean, if you have bananas around, that's just an incredible option, and they're like almost instant. The second answer is the three-ingredient peanut butter cookies that are all over the internet. Just Google three-ingredient peanut butter cookies. It's egg, sugar, and peanut butter. Mm. And those are also super fast and delicious. And you can impress people with how quickly these things come together. So that's fun too.
I have two ideas. One is the, you know, the brownies from How to Cook Everything, which my friend Ed told me that Nick Malgeri's brownies are better. So I have to try those, but they're really good. And that thing, that trick you invented when you were a kid of putting aluminum foil in the pan, so you can really just, now I use parchment paper, so you just pull them right out. I mean, that's just pretty simple. The second is, come on, you don't have time to stop at the gas station and buy Häagen-Dazs or six Chipwiches or something like that. That's a pretty good dessert.
Hey, Mark. My name is Liza Page. My question is, expiration dates, how accurate are those? And do you really need to pay attention? Like, I know, yes, meat goes bad. I know that. And but some expiration dates are so far out. And so now I go to the market and I look at cans and stuff, let's say canned beans or even milk. I mean, like, why is some milk good for 2 months and some milk good for 2 weeks? Like, I don't get it.
Well, that second thing, that last thing is very specific. And the difference is that normally pasteurized milk is good for 10 days or 2 weeks, whatever. And then ultra pasteurized milk keeps a long, long time. And that's an example of an expiration date you probably can ignore. Because I think I've used box milk, ultra high temperature. It's UHT milk. I've used it a year after the expiration date. It's been fine. I don't think canned goods really have an expiration date. I mean, if the can rusts or bulges or is dented, damaged, you know, I wouldn't trust that. But I think the whole idea of canning is that the food keeps basically forever. So the expiration date there is completely made up. I mean, there's a whole history of why that is, but it's not that important. But I think canned goods, jarred goods, if the seal is good, then the food inside should be good. And if it's not, it's going to have mold or smell terrible or something. And fresh ingredients don't need an expiration date because you know when they go bad, they start to smell. So it's really pretty simple. I don't pay much attention to expiration dates.
Hi, my name is Susan Richardson, and my question is about sourdough bread. I actually have a couple questions. First, what makes real sourdough bread real? For example, I've read that you can't add yeast to sourdough bread. If you do, it's not real sourdough. And number two, I live in Texas currently. I grew up on the west coast of California and, of course, an abundance of beautiful sourdough bread available. But in Texas, I'm not finding so much. So I'm wondering, as consumers at the supermarket, what should we look for on the label of sourdough bread to know or have an idea that maybe we're getting some good stuff?
I mean, it's a purist question. And I think what makes sourdough bread real is using a natural starter. If your starter is weak, though, and you feel like adding a pinch of yeast is going to make the difference between a lousy bread and a better bread, who's going to call you up and say your sourdough bread isn't real? I don't think it's going to happen. I mean, some purist is going to respond to this and say, oh, this is terrible. You can't add yeast to sourdough, but you can. I've done it. It works. If you start a sourdough and you're eager to get bread going, Typically, when you're building a sourdough, you throw some of it out every now and then, or you use it for pancakes or whatever. You can use it to start a bread. And if it just doesn't seem to have enough oomph to get that bread going, you add a pinch of yeast and it works great. And you call that sourdough bread. So I don't think, Susan, that you need to worry about this.
Okay, so that is it for this week's questions. Please remember, if you have a question about food, cooking, whatever, anything food, call our toll-free, wow, it is toll-free listener question line at 833-FOOD-POD. That's 833-366-3763. Leave us a message with your email address and phone number and name, please. Okay, thanks. The fish in our oceans are not protected as they should be. One reaction to this, which we discussed in my newsletter a couple of weeks ago, is let's not eat fish. We shouldn't eat fish. But the we in that question is tricky because there are a billion people around the world, and most of them are poor, who depend upon fish as their primary source of protein. So while in the long run, humans might eat less fish, in the short run, saying eat no fish is not a solution. The solution is worldwide management of fish resources, true outlawing of pirates and fishing operations that employ slave labor, of which there are quite a few, better management of those fish that remain. Some species like bluefin tuna are really going to be off limits to most of us for a while. Others like cod and haddock and yellowfin tuna and many, many others can be made to be sustainable at current levels as long as management is good. Just wanted to also thank the great Ted Danson and the great Daniel Pauly for their time for this podcast. I hope, I'm sure you learned a lot about oceans and ocean policy, overfishing, etc., and totally serious topic that we are happy to be able to cover with such knowledgeable and entertaining people. You may want to have a look at Oceana's website, and it is oceana.org, oceana.org, an organization well worth supporting, and they have awesome reading material on their website. Folks, if you liked today's episode, and if you're still listening, I can assume that you did, then please subscribe to Food with Mark Bittman on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you like to listen. It would be real helpful if you left us a 5-star review on Apple, and detailed reviews are the best way for new listeners to discover the show. You can find the recipe from today's show in the episode show notes or at bittmanproject.com or at markbittman.com. They all kind of go to the same place. Finally, Food with Mark Bittman is a part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. Check out Airwave's other shows at airwavemedia.com or wherever you get your podcast. I'm Mark Bittman, and thanks again for listening to Food. See you next week.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.